We welcome you all, and I'm Pat Schroeder, and the person to my immediate left is Congresswoman Yvonne Burke from California. So we're very happy to have her up here, too. We also have a very brave and noble congressman, and I think he's a very special friend of women, and we should really commend him for coming. Congressman George Brown is here from California down there. We salute you and thank you for joining us this morning. I'm sure many people wonder why we put this on the program and what we're trying to do. Let me just try and give you a very brief summary. First of all, in an attempt to deal with the whole area of peace, disarmament, the military budget, and attempting to deal with it in a very short period of time, it's very frustrating. Because no matter what we touch, I'm sure some of you will think, well, why didn't you discuss neutron bombs, or why didn't you discuss this, or why didn't you discuss something else? It's very difficult to do. We thought this was important to do this at this time because, as you know, the UN special session on disarmament will be convening in May of 1978. So this is kind of a preliminary hearing and discussion similar to what you might be hearing, some of the issues you may be hearing in that disarmament discussion in 1978 in May. Although, remember, they're going to have a whole conference built around it, and we're trying to do this in just a short period of time. The reason we felt it was so important to have this at this conference is it seems to me the whole purpose of the Women's Conference in Houston is to say that women are no longer going to be mere observers. We're going to be participants. We're going to be full participants. For too long, and especially in the military peace disarmament era, we have been preempted from having real discussions. For much too long, it has been considered, quote, men's business. And we have no business being there. And yet, when you look at it, everything that's ever been done has been done in the name of protecting women and children. The only problem is people forget to consult the women and children to find out if that's how we really wanted to be protected. We're often taxed to death in all sorts of programs the women and children feel strongly about, or starved to death in order to protect us in a manner that we may not believe is the way we want it to go. So today I think it's very significant that the women in Houston are saying, no longer are we going to observe, no longer are we going to passively rubber stamp what is being handed to us as protection in our name. We're going to participate and engage in the preliminary era of peace, disarmament, and all that. We've got SALT going on, the SALT talks, which you've read so much about. We've got MBFR going on, which has been going on forever and may never come to any settlement, although I hope it does. There are any number of other serious issues. We all know the size of the military budget. When we talk about $120 billion, I only need to remind you that a billion is 1,000 million, that a billion seconds equals about 7 days, but a billion minutes equals about 32 years. I mean, you start figuring out what a billion means, and I don't think any of us in this room can fathom it. So we're spending gross amounts of money. That's happening all over the world. Unfortunately, we're not unique. It's become a real power trip of sorts. And as we look at the political structure of the world, it seems that many political leaders only feel secure if they have lots of technological things to drag out through the streets on parades. And that's supposed to swell your nationalism, and we're sorry we don't have any hospital benefits or good educational programs or even food to feed the people, but everyone must understand we need tanks. That's the issue we're trying to grope with. I'm very, very proud of the panelists that are here today because I think, if you look at them, how many dispense and disarmament panels have you seen that are this heavily female? Very rarely are they. And I'm sure they'll go in different ways, but that's also what we're going to find, you know, as we deal with the issue. Certainly they are. None of them have braid on, none of them have ribbons, and none of them have a military uniform. But that is that has been the glory of our country, is supposedly the military is civilian controlled, and too often the civilians most interested are the ones with the special interests, i.e. the weapons salespeople or something. So I think a good counterpoint is to have women becoming very knowledgeable in these areas, because if there's anything that impacts on all of us, part of the reason that we have been able to come and meet and talk about many of the other issues that concern us very deeply has been because we don't have a war going on. If we have a war going on, everything we're worried about gets pushed to one side because the new priority becomes the war. So peace, disarmament, all those things really are important so we can continue the discussions that we start here on the many other issues we feel strongly about. So I welcome you, and I think we're going to have a very stimulating panel discussion here. Let me try and explain what the format is going to be. We're going to have to be a little bit tight with our time because, as you know, we're running into the next session a bit. We will have about 45 minutes for the panel presentations, and then we'll have questions from here, from Yvonne and I, and then we'll have questions later on from the floor. We will also have four-minute presentations from women who represent certain groups who have been very active in this area and can tell you what we might do to follow through and continue the education process or the interest that we hope to stimulate today. And then we'll have some questions and answers from the floor. Then we have Margaret Mead in the audience, who doesn't want to stand up here in the bright lights, and I don't blame you, Margaret, but she's really one of the great minds of our time who's going to try and make some comments about what she heard here. And at that point, we hope that we can adjourn and not run too much into the other session. So thank you, and let us begin with the panel, if that's all right. I'm not sure, do you have the biographies of the panelists or not? I guess not. Okay, well, let me start with each of them. How would you like to go? Who wants to go? You want to go first, Randall. Okay, I've got them down here. Oh, you've got them. You've got them down there, too. We've got them in a different order. Okay, Randall Forsberg, then we will have lead off. She is a fellow at the Program for Science and International Affairs at Harvard University and has specialized in arms control matters. Believe me, there are not a whole lot of women who have specialized in this area, so we're very pleased to have her here with us, and we'll be interested to hear what you have to say, Randall.
Thanks very much, Congresswoman Schroeder and Congresswoman Burke. I'm honored to testify before you, and I'd like to underline the message that Pat Schroeder just gave us. I'm delighted to be able to speak before a women's group. I think that if we're going to have a safe military policy in this country, the majority of the people have to participate in shaping the policy. Today, the only people who can tell you where the defense budget goes are those with a personal stake in it, and that's quite a lot of people. There are 5 million employees in the Defense Department and the arms industries, and there are another 2 million reservists and retired military officers. Naturally, these people have an interest in seeing that the military budget isn't cut. Now, what powerful group is there on the other side? People who have a personal interest in paying attention to our military policy and in making sure that the forces and the budget are kept to a minimum. There is no such special group. There are only the citizens at large, people like you, half of them women, whose taxes, quality of life, political and social order, peace, and ultimately even survival are at stake. For this reason, it's essential that you and women throughout America know what military forces the United States has and what the rationales for these forces are. Form your own opinion of what would be a safe military force, and then work for political action on these issues. Now, I'd like to start this process by describing the components of U.S. forces and their functions, and then showing why I think there's a wide margin for arms reductions. As I run through these components, I think you'll find that they're rather like the emperor's new clothes, in the sense that if you speak quite literally about it, almost none of the defense budget goes to national defense. And this is something I'd like you to watch for as I go through different pieces. U.S. combat forces are divided into two main kinds, called strategic and general purpose. strategic means concerned with the vital interests of the country. General purpose is a catch-all for everything else. Now, surprisingly, out of this $120 billion defense budget, only about $20 billion out of the $120 goes to the strategic forces, while $80 billion goes to the general purpose forces, four times as much. Within the strategic category, there's a further division between what are officially called offensive forces and defensive forces. Strategic defense is for the defense of the territory of the United States. Strategic offense is for attacking the territory of other countries, mainly the Soviet Union. It is these offensive strategic weapons that are the long-range nuclear weapons that we hear so much about. These include 400 of the B-52 bomber aircraft built around 1960, which can carry around 5 nuclear bombs each. They also include long-range ballistic missiles. A ballistic missile is a missile that follows a path like a ball that's thrown up into the air. Like the rockets that put men on the moon, these missiles are made up mostly of rocket motors and fuel, which burn and fall off during the first 3 minutes of the flight. At that point, the nose cone of the missile is out in space on a path that will put it on a target 6,000 miles away only 30 minutes later. These nuclear warheads that are in the nose cone re-enter the atmosphere at about 20,000 miles an hour, or 20 times the speed of sound. You know, when you hear about a fast airplane, that's two or three times the speed of sound. That's a supersonic airplane. A missile comes in at 20 times the speed of sound. This is so fast that nothing men have been able to devise is fast enough to stop it reliably. And for this reason, there is no defense against long-range ballistic missiles. The United States has 1,000 of these intercontinental ballistic missiles called ICBMs, built between 1960 and 1967. They are located underground in concrete reinforced silos in 8 western and midwestern states. There's a comparable force of Soviet ICBMs, 1,500 instead of 1,000, built between 1964 and 1971. There are also similar missiles based on submarines called submarine-launched ballistic missiles, or SLBMs. The United States has 41 strategic submarines with 16 ballistic missiles on each one, which makes about 650 of these SLBMs. They were also built between 1960 and 1967. The Soviet Union started building submarines like this just as we were finishing in 1967, and they are only now completing their production run of 54 submarines. Some of them have 12 missiles on them, some have 16, and altogether there are 800 of the Soviet SLBMs. So in all, with the bombers and the land-based missiles and the submarine-based missiles, this makes about 2,000 of what are called delivery vehicles for nuclear, intercontinental delivery of nuclear weapons. It's very important to realize that these large forces of ballistic missiles, against which we have no defense, and which can turn the entire urban areas of the United States and the Soviet Union to rubble in half an hour, killing 200 million people instantly, 100 million in this country and 100 million in that country, which is all the people that live in urban areas, is not ancient history, but a product of our own lifetimes and our political systems. A danger like this has never existed before in human history, and it is our current political responsibility. Recently, between 1970 and this year, 1977, most of the original American missiles have been replaced by new missiles, which instead of carrying one giant H-bomb, have several smaller nuclear warheads about Hiroshima size. These multiple reentry vehicles, called MIRVs, have increased the number of nuclear warheads on the U.S. land-based missiles from 1,000 to 2,000. On the submarines, there are 10 separate nuclear bombs on each missile. That means that we've increased the number of warheads on the submarine-based force from about 650, which is how many missiles there are, to 5,000 separate nuclear bombs that can be delivered by those 650 missiles. Now, if you add in the 2,000 bombs that we have on the bomber aircraft, the United States gets an overall total of 9,000 nuclear warheads deliverable at intercontinental range. The Soviet Union is lagging 5 or 6 years behind us in this multiple warhead technology. They're just starting now. They have around 3,000 of these intercontinental nuclear warheads, but by the early 1980s, we can expect that they'll have 10,000 too. There are only about 50 large cities in either country. The United States already has programs underway to replace the generation that we just finished with these multiple warheads, the last of which came in 1977, with a new submarine called Trident, which will have 24 multiple warhead missiles on each submarine instead of 16 multiple warhead missiles on each submarine, and a new land-based missile called MX, which will also have larger warheads. These offensive forces absorb about $18 billion out of the $20 billion that goes to the strategic weapons. Their function is not to defend this country in any traditional sense. It's to deter a nuclear attack on us by threatening retaliation after the fact. Now, in contrast, the other $2 or $3 billion out of the strategic category does go to defense, strategic defense. This is the only component of the American military budget aimed strictly at the national defense of the United States. This component accounts for less than 5% of our military spending. It's made up of four things: radars, to warn us of a bomber or missile attack, and if it's a missile attack, to give us about 20 minutes to evacuate the cities. A small number of interceptor aircraft in case the Soviet Union decides to use their 100 obsolete bombers instead of their ICBMs. We can intercept the bombers. Three, research on short-range missiles designed to intercept the incoming ICBMs. But as I mentioned earlier, no way has been found to do this reliably. And four, civil defense shelters. About 0.1% of the budget goes to this. There is also the Coast Guard, which protects our coastal waters. But ironically, the Coast Guard is financed by the Department of Transportation instead of the Department of Defense, because there's no military threat to our coasts. Now, what about these general purpose forces that take $80 billion out of the budget? The non-nuclear conventional arms, World War II type, Vietnam type, what do? First, there are ground troops, 1 million men in the Army and the Marines. Then there are tactical fighter planes, to give the ground troops air cover and to attack enemy ground troops. And there are naval forces. The Air Force and Navy parts of these conventional forces each have about 500,000 men, 2 million men in uniform in all. These forces are not maintained to defend the United States, for there is no non-nuclear military threat to this country. Neither the Soviet Union nor any other country has the transport ships and aircraft, the logistics support, the firepower cover, or the foothold on this continent that would be required to launch a conventional attack on the United States. So what are they supposed to do? About half of the Army consists of what are called heavy divisions with a lot of tanks. These are meant to help defend Western Europe in a non-nuclear war with the Soviet Union. The rest of the Army and the Marines are light divisions with fewer tanks. These are oriented mainly to the Pacific and to intervention in developing countries like Vietnam or Korea. The Navy's roles are split like the Army's, between reinforcing Western Europe and intervening in developing countries, with most of the emphasis on the second. Attack of weaker military powers is the main use of the Navy's aircraft carriers and amphibious landing ships, which are vulnerable to Soviet attack, which are needed only for areas where we do not have secure bases or a lot of local popular support, and which, together with their escort ships and supply ships and aircraft, account for well over half of the Navy's budget. The rest of the Navy is composed of patrol aircraft, anti-submarine submarines, and convoy escorts, all of which are supposed to keep open the supply lines to Western Europe in case there is a long non-nuclear World War II type war in Europe. The Air Force's land-based combat aircraft that I mentioned earlier are flexible. They could be used either in Europe or in the Third World. What this means is that altogether, the general purpose forces on which we're spending $80 billion are oriented about half to defending Western Europe in case we have a non-nuclear war there, like World War II, and half toward intervening in the Third World. One more thing has to be added to this picture before I come to my conclusions. The general purpose forces are equipped to fight without nuclear weapons as they did in Vietnam. But they also have short-range nuclear weapons called tactical nuclear weapons. Their function is to attack other military forces, aircraft, ships, tanks, that sort of thing. These weapons are ignored in the United States because they're not expected to be used on U.S. or Soviet territory. But in Europe and Far East, where they might be used, people are not so indifferent to them. The United States has, in addition to the 9,000 intercontinental range nuclear weapons that I mentioned earlier, 20,000 of these short-range nuclear weapons, which we can use to help defend our allies around the world. Taken together, it appears that U.S. military forces have very little to do directly with the defense of this country. They are much more concerned with providing the capability to intervene in conflicts in virtually all parts of the globe and across the full spectrum of military power. Guerrilla warfare, big conventional wars, supposedly contained tactical nuclear wars, and up to intercontinental nuclear exchange. To the extent that these forces are based on rational considerations and not just inertia and illusory fears, they derive from a militarized approach to foreign policy. They permit and encourage an active interventionist position which relies on being one up militarily in every type of force and every sort of crisis. In my view, this is a dangerous and unnecessary military policy for three reasons. First, it links the nuclear forces to confrontations over what may originally be very small issues in remote parts of the globe. It makes this link by the theoretical chain of escalation, which is the thing that places importance on technical advantages and disadvantages and warfighting capabilities in nuclear weapons, the sort of developments that have been going on during the last 10 years and which are expected for the next 10 years, above and beyond the basic undeniable capability of both the United States and the Soviet Union to destroy each other's urban populations. Second, as the leader in armaments technically and the world's strongest military power in an all-round sense, the United States helps perpetuate a high level of conventional arms, an arms race in conventional arms not in the developing countries but in the industrial countries, which account for a very large share, as you can see here, of the world's military spending. We are maintaining a conventional arms race in a world where almost no one believes that a big conventional war, a long 2 or 3 year war among the industrialized countries, is possible any longer. Maintaining these arms may increase the likelihood of such a war, and it may also dampen or obstruct the development which is well underway of constructive international relations. Third, with regard to both the nuclear and the conventional arms, the resources absorbed by the military in the United States and the Soviet Union, and increasingly in other countries, particularly in the Third World, have represented a much larger portion of the national product since World War II than was ever the case in peacetime before. 5 to 10% since World War II, as against at most 1 to 3% in peacetime throughout the world before that time. There seems to be no rational cause or excuse for the present degree of militarization, except perhaps the failure of the populations in the large industrial countries to insist that it is not necessary to be heavily armed in order to deter war. Indeed, that the poised balance of excessive arms, particularly nuclear arms, poses a far greater threat than smaller military forces would do. This conclusion, that a high level of arms is more dangerous than a low level, is a matter of judgment. As you listen and read about arms control during and after this meeting, I hope that you will reflect on that judgment. And if you come to the same conclusion, that you will encourage other women to find out what's going on in U.S. military policy and to play an active part in reducing the danger and the waste. Thank you.
I must confess that I sit on the House Armed Services Committee, Randall, and that is not their viewpoint. But I must say that it's very refreshing to hear you point that out, because I certainly am much more of a kindred spirit of yours than I am with my colleagues, so it's nice to for once be on a panel where I have more people I agree with than disagree with. Our next witness this morning is Dr. Helen Caldicott. I always get hung up on that. Forgive me. She's a pediatrician who specializes in cystic fibrosis at the Children's Hospital Medical Center in Boston. She's been very famous in that she's one of the people who didn't just passively get involved. She got very actively involved in the Australian movement in opposition to the French atomic tests in the Pacific Ocean in 1972. It's one thing to talk. It's often another thing to act. Here is a woman who both talks and acts. And Helen, we're very happy to have you with us this morning.
Thank you very much. It's a great honor to be here to come as a pediatrician and a mother to talk to my fellow sisters about something that's worried me since I was 17 years old when I did first year medicine and discovered what the effects of radiation were to the human body. At that time, you remember, Russia and America were testing bombs extensively in the atmosphere, and I've watched in horror ever since as they've built more and more and more of these hideous weapons. This is the ultimate insanity. Nuclear weapons are a diabolical force which threaten the very future of the human race. The only experiences we've had of atomic bombs so far being dropped on human populations are those that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bomb on Hiroshima had the explosive power of 12,500 tons of TNT. Some of the bombs they build now are 6,000 times bigger than that. That bomb killed 200,400 people. Not all died immediately. Let me tell you what happened. Thousands died instantaneously of blast and burns. 2 weeks later, a new illness started appearing, which doctors had virtually never seen before. What is called is acute radiation illness. What happens is all the actively dividing cells of the body die. So people's hair dropped out, their skin sloughed off in big ulcers. They got vomiting and diarrhea. And as their red and white blood cells and platelets died, they died of infection and or massive hemorrhage, very similar to the way people die when they have leukemia, which incidentally is also caused by radiation. Because 5 years later, there was an epidemic of leukemia which occurred among the survivors. You must know that of all animals on Earth, human beings are the most sensitive to the effects of radiation. We get cancer most easily. And of all human beings on Earth, it's fetuses, infants and young children who are exquisitely sensitive to these effects and who get cancer most easily. You must also know it takes 15 years about from the time of radiation to the time that people get cancer. So 5 years later, and it only takes 5 years to get leukemia. There was an epidemic of leukemia. It increased five times among the survivors. 15 years later, solid cancer started appearing among the survivors of breast, bowel, thyroid, lung, and other organs. It is now approximately 30 years since that bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, and the incidence of cancer is still rising. In other words, we don't know the peak time of the maximum incidence of cancer to appear from the time of radiation exposure. It is probable that in future generations of children born to those survivors, there will be increased incidence of inherited disease and deformed babies. Many of the babies who were in utero when that bomb was dropped were born with tiny heads, microcephaly, because although mature brain cells are very resistant to the effects of radiation, immature brain cells are exquisitely sensitive, and those brain cells died. After a bomb is dropped, much of the water and food is polluted with things, radioactive elements called fallout, like radioactive iodine, which gets concentrated in the food cycle, and if you drink it in milk, it will give you thyroid cancer. Strontium-90, which gets concentrated in the food cycle, and if you drink it in milk, will go to your bone and give you bone cancer and leukemia. Plutonium occurs in atomic bombs, the most carcinogenic substance we know. 1/1,000,000th of a gram will give you a cancer. It causes cancer of the lung, cancer of the liver, cancer of the bone, leukemia. It is handled like iron in the body, and it crosses the placenta, the organ that feeds the developing fetus, where it can kill a cell which will form the right half of the brain, so the baby will be born deformed. It is thalidomide. Remember that drug pregnant women took which damaged developing fetuses? Only it lasts for 500,000 years. That is produced in atomic explosions. There is no way to survive a nuclear war. As Randy just said, it takes half an hour from the press of the button to virtually elimination of most life, certainly in the Northern Hemisphere. Don't delude yourselves. You can't get in a shelter and survive a nuclear war. The shelters that people will be in directly under where the bomb is dropped will be totally destroyed. If you're on the periphery of the bomb, there's such a terrific blast effect that the shelters will collapse, and such terrific fire that everything will be burnt and all the oxygen will be consumed. If you did survive in a shelter and you came out, you'd have to stay in there for 2 weeks if there was enough oxygen. You would enter a world totally polluted by radiation. The water, the air, and the food would be totally polluted. You might die in 2 weeks of acute radiation illness, or you might get leukemia 5 years later, or survive long enough to get your cancer in 15 years, if indeed you survived, because you see, nearly all the doctors would be killed because doctors live in the urban areas. There would be no hospital beds. There would be no transport. There would be no ways of obtaining food. The psychiatric consequences of this would be enormous among the survivors as well, if there were.